For 18 years, my next guest was a member of the House of Commons in the UK, and today is an independent crossbench life peer in the House of Lords. He's well known internationally for his work as a pro-life and human rights campaigner. He's written extensively on controversial issues ranging from abortion, eugenics, human cloning, euthanasia. Last night he gave a talk at the invitation of the so-called Life Society at NUI Galway entitled The Culture of Death Versus the Culture of Life. Lord David Alton is in our Galway studio this morning, and we're also joined on the line by Dr. Mary Favier from a group entitled Doctors for Choice. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Now, David Alton, I'll begin with you, if I may. What message were you trying to get across in your talk last evening?
Well, I've been particularly asked to look at the consequences of the 1967 Abortion Act in Britain, what it had led to, and I set out the figures. For instance, there have been 7 million abortions since 1967. That's running now at nearly 200,000 a year, with 600 nearly every day. And I was also asked to look at the extension of the Abortion Act to Northern Ireland, which is likely to take place in the context of a new human fertilisation and embryology bill, which is currently before the British Parliament. And that also, of course, includes provision for creating things like animal-human hybrid embryos, and that is on the back of 2.2 million human embryos being destroyed or experimented on in Britain in the past 15 years. But I also went on to look at the whole eugenics culture and how in Europe now, in countries like Holland and Belgium, euthanasia has been legalised, and how in Holland we've moved from, first of all, so-called voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia, with 4,000 deaths now every year. One in four of them are involuntary.
How do we know they're involuntary? Because that would suggest that someone's life is taken without them asking a doctor.
Well, that's permission. Precisely the point, Pat. They don't give their consent in one in four cases, and these are figures that are issued by the Dutch government.
But are these cases where doctors maybe perhaps over-medicate to relieve pain, a side effect of which is the death of the patient?
But that's not euthanasia. If a doctor acts in good faith and provides what's called double effect, and this is primarily to relieve pain, if it hastens death, then that is a side effect. That isn't euthanasia. But if someone like Harold Chipman, who killed hundreds of his patients, deliberately gives a lethal injection, or the nurse who was convicted in Britain only a week ago after killing a number of patients, by elderly people, by injecting them with insulin, that is euthanasia. And with the full force of law in Holland and in Belgium, and now within the last month in Luxembourg, they have now legalised euthanasia, the deliberate killing of people who are terminally ill, but whose life is not about to end naturally.
But how is this done without their consent? I mean, we're aware of the law that permits people to give consent for such an intervention, but how can they do it without consent of next of kin, or indeed the patient themselves, if they are still compos mentis?
Well, it's a good point, because this is exactly what happens when sometimes well-intentioned people, often doctors, who say, well, I don't like the invidious position I've been placed in, and sometimes patients are dying, and maybe I might be accused of having hastened death, and this is what happened in Holland. They moved from that position to saying, well, we will legalise voluntary euthanasia, that is where someone, a patient, gives consent for their life to be taken. And then you move on a little bit further, and what happened in Holland then is that they moved from voluntary euthanasia to legalising involuntary euthanasia, so that somebody else, a patient's relative, or someone connected with the family, can give permission for that person to be killed. And often this can have undue pressure attached to it. It can have other motivations.
Okay, sometimes it's clear that somebody has to give consent next to kin.
Somebody, Well, yes, but not the patient themselves. So it's involuntary in that respect.
How different is it to somebody who's called in, their loved one is on a life support machine, the brain stem is dead, and they say, look, we're thinking of pulling the plug. What do you think?
Well, again, there's a false parallels, because if someone is dying anyway, and if someone is brain dead, as you've just described it, then in those circumstances, it's perfectly licit for people to bring about the natural end to someone's life. We don't have to go to heroic lengths to keep someone alive who would otherwise die. And I think there's often confusion about this. But what is permitted in Holland is the administration of a lethal injection to kill a patient who has not given permission for that to take place. And these are people who are not necessarily at the very end of their lives.
You do not hesitate to use fairly graphic materials in your speeches of, for example, I'm looking at some pictures supplied by your office to us, the feet of a 10-week-old child aborted. A child aborted at 11 weeks. These are photographs. A child aborted at 21 weeks. A child aborted at 24 weeks. And you, I presume you showed these pictures last night.
There are four pictures, which have also, of course, images like this have been shown on Channel 4 television in Britain recently for the first time. People say it's often just a choice to take the life of an unborn child. It's not a choice, it's a child. The point in showing the photographs is this, that abortion in Britain is allowed up to 24 weeks gestation in ordinary circumstances. 98% of abortions are done under the social clause and have nothing whatsoever to do with so-called hard cases. And abortion is permitted up to and during birth itself if there's a disability involved. And that can be something as minor as club foot or cleft palate. And I showed a photograph last night of a young woman, Joanna Jepson, who had cleft palate and went to court a couple of years ago to challenge the abortion of babies with cleft palate up to birth. Now, the point is that babies have been born as early as 21 weeks gestation and have lived. So how can people justify this? They justify it by not looking at the reality, and they say it's just someone's choice. Well, when we're confronted with the reality, we often change our minds.
Do you have any time for the hard cases?
Well, of course, I think we should not be judgmental or condemnatory. We should be compassionate. And some of the other pictures I showed last night were of the life houses and life offices that have been created throughout the United Kingdom. And I know that there are comparable organisations here in Ireland. The hospices that life have created for dying babies, for instance. We have to reach out and care for a woman and her child. Many women feel they have no choice. And that's why we shouldn't be against, we shouldn't just be against abortion or euthanasia and be no-sayers. We have to be positive. Pro-life for the woman and the child. We have to defend life at every stage. My late mother, who was from the west of Ireland, was an Irish speaker. She brought me up to believe in the sanctity of human life, and I think we've drifted a long way from that. Where in a country like the United Kingdom, we can destroy 7 million unborn children, and hardly a voice is raised in protest. When we can allow abortion up to and even during birth on a baby with a disability. When we destroy 2.2 million human embryos. When we give greater protection to a fox in British law than we do to an unborn child, then I think we've got our values upside down.
Right, Dr. Mary Favier from the group called Doctors for Choice, what's your response to this?
My response is that we do indeed need to focus on life, but we need to focus on life as it's lived by women and families and people every day. We need to focus on the reality of their lives. And whether we like it or not, and abortion is a very difficult decision and a very individual and personal decision, women are making this choice every day. The 6,000 or so Irish women who travel to the UK every year are those 6,000 making that life decision and affirming their right to make a choice themselves. The 124,000 women in England and Wales who had abortions in 2006. Is David Alton suggesting that we turn our back on their lives and say, well, now you must continue an unwanted pregnancy, a forced pregnancy? It's a very difficult area, but that we must exist in the reality. And as a general practitioner, I see women grapple with these very difficult decisions on a regular basis. And I think it's an extraordinary decision to make. And I think for David Alton to say that it's made lightly or flippantly or for social reasons is an insult to the women involved and their
families.
Mary,
the figures from the Department of Health in Britain are that 98% of all abortions are done under the social clause. So I'm not saying these are the official figures. 98%.
And I accept they're done under the social clause, but social clause is a very broad way of describing women who could go through this decision.
People having multiple abortions, six or seven abortions? Do you justify abortion up to birth on a disabled baby?
I'm not justifying whether people have multiple abortions. I'm respecting that that is the choice that some individual women make in very difficult circumstances. And I think to say that any woman and her partner and her family make that choice flippantly or casually is wrong and inappropriate. We need to look at why women have abortions. We need to look at what we can do to improve contraception and sexuality education, and we need to support women in a very difficult choice.
Well, whatever else there is in Britain, there's no shortage of contraception. That isn't really the issue. We've just turned this into a choice rather than seeing it what it is. As a child, you have two patients in front of you once a baby has been conceived, and you have a duty of care to both. The Hippocratic Oath always said quite explicitly that no doctor should ever be involved in terminating the life of an unborn child.
And the the most important person and the only one that we can give overriding rights to in this circumstance is the woman, because she carries that child within her, that fetus, that won't become a living, sentient human being until it's born, and then that child has rights.
That's not true. The leading expert on fetal pain in the world was recently in Britain. He was also featured on the Channel 4 programme I mentioned, Dr. Sunny Anand, and he said there's incontrovertible evidence, that was his phrase, that the unborn child feels pain during these abortions that take place. You have a duty of care to the child as well as the mother. Why don't you promote the alternative of adoption? In Britain, for instance, last year, 160 babies, that's all, were available throughout the whole year for adoption, and yet every day we abort 600.
So are you suggesting that the 6,000 Irish women who travel every year should be forced to continue their pregnancies, regardless of the circumstances, and place babies for adoption? That's just not a reality. That is not going to happen. Women, if that was to happen in Ireland or in the UK, as you well know, we would be resorting to backstreet abortions, we would have botched abortions, and we would have a huge rise in the maternal mortality rate.
But there's a massive
increase. Whether we like abortion or not, it's a social reality. We need to stay with that and work with it to make it a more reasonable procedure. We may need to decriminalise it in Ireland.
It can never be reasonable to destroy an unborn child in a dilation and evacuation.
In a balance between the life of a woman and her right to self.
It is an excruciating pain.
A woman has a right to self-determine her own choices. It is not for you or I to tell an individual woman how to live her life or how to determine its bodily functions.
But that is what the law is all about. That is why civilised societies have hitherto previously always outlawed abortion, because it is the taking of life. It isn't just a personal choice. It's not my personal choice to go out on the street and gun someone down.
Progressive societies have actually moved further than the UK scenario and have decriminalised abortion. So if you take the Canadian legislature, they do not have any legislation governing abortion. There's no procedure of abortion, as there's no procedure of hysterectomy or appendicectomy in their legislation.
Mary, to get to that point, they had to pass laws in the Canadian Parliament. That's the whole point. They pass laws to make that the situation.
And they have chosen to decriminalise it, accepting that it's a medical procedure and it's a decision made between a woman and her advisors, and it needs to stay as that. It's not palatable, it's not pleasant, but it's a reality. And the situation in Ireland is that all 1 in 10 women of reproductive age in Ireland have had an abortion.
Can I ask you something, Dr. Mary Favier, because looking at the pictures of a child aborted at 24 weeks, and we know that the wonderful medics in places like the Rotunda and Holles Street can actually keep alive those premature births that happened at around 24, 25, 26 weeks. Whether that's a wise thing to try to do is a subject that's still being debated. But isn't there something very wrong about a child just to the point of viability being aborted? Is that too late an abortion by your books?
I think the most important thing to know is that the number of abortions taking place at around the 22 to 24 weeks are exceptionally rare. And they're taken usually in exceptional circumstances where, and unfortunately, a number of Irish women part of this late abortion culture because of all the difficulties we have in Ireland with it being illegal and them going to England late. And so that's a particular issue for Irish women we need to address. But to say that fetal viability should be where you put your legal limit for abortion is very problematic, because if you say, as David Austin has suggested, you bring it down to 18 weeks, well, why not bring it down to 12 weeks? If in the future you could get an artificial uterus and the baby could be sustained, are you suggesting that women are to be forced into continued pregnancy and motherhood because of these circumstances? We need to make it a situation where a woman continues to take advice from her medical advisors, regardless of the gestational age, in very difficult circumstances. Women do not have abortions.
Do you believe that that should be on medical grounds only? I mean, the social grounds that David has been talking about, where perhaps suddenly the partner, who is the father of the child, does a runner, and at some point along the way, at 21, 22 weeks, when the partner has done a runner, the woman says, well, I was going to raise this child with your man. He's gone, so I'm not going to do it now. I mean, is that a reasonable reason for having an abortion at that late stage? A medical reason, you can make a very strong case, perhaps.
Yes, I think if the woman were in those circumstances and she was 23 and a half weeks pregnant, I think, first of all, it would be exceptionally rare. But I could only imagine the extraordinary distress and difficulty she would be in to be wrestling with that decision at that stage. And this, just to say that it was because the previous week he'd been there there and then he does a runner, I think is to make little of how difficult it is and how women grapple with it.
No, I'm just wondering, should it be made, I use that as an example of whether or not it should be made extremely difficult for someone to abort a child at that late stage.
It is already extremely difficult, fact, because a woman needs to see two doctors who both need to sign the form. And the other difficulty is finding obstetricians gynecologists who participate that late. The interesting thing is the vast majority of gynecologists in the UK support the 24-week limit, even though they may not actually actively practice it themselves, but they respect a woman's right to undergo an abortion before that date. And I think we need to, it's not good law to change it. We need to keep it the way it is and work consistently that women, if they're going to have abortions, have them early, or that they're never placed in that situation in the first place.
David?
No, well, this is simply not true. The average European Union time limit, this is taking all the European Union countries together, is 13 weeks gestation. So the United Kingdom is way out of step anyway with the rest of Europe. And
that depends on which countries in Europe you're including.
I'm talking about every country in the
Ireland, Malta,
I'm talking about every country in the European Union, and I'm talking about the average of all those countries. I've made that clear.
Is it the average of countries that permit abortion, or
almost every country in the European Union permits abortion, and if you take them all together, the average is 13 weeks. No one denies that. That's a fact. And in the United Kingdom, we are way out of line. We allow abortion up to 24 weeks gestation and up to birth in cases of disability. And I've been challenging that law because I think it's cruel and I think it's barbaric. Many doctors in Britain are opposed to abortion. Many now use the conscience clause to opt out of being involved in abortions. They look for alternatives. You can carry out operations in utero, for instance, on a baby in order to deal with things like spina bifida. I show a photograph of a baby who was operated on successfully in utero, but back into the womb at 21 weeks gestation. You don't need to kill a baby in order to do it. What are we saying about disability? That it would be better that someone should be dead rather than being allowed to live. We'll campaign for ramps on public buildings, but will permit abortion up to birth on grounds like cleft palate or club foot. And as I said, the issue of pain, doctors themselves have now come forward with terrific evidence on this issue that we should take into account, but also the effects on women's health. There's a lot of evidence now about links with breast cancer and, of course, the psychological damage as well. You can scrape a child out of a mother's womb, but not out of her heart or out of her mind. And doctors should be defenders of life, not the destroyers of life.
The anti-choice lobby have lost the arguments on moral grounds because the vast majority of the population say we don't like abortion, but it's a social reality. We respect people's right to choose it.
Well, interestingly, the United Kingdom, where
What
the anti-choice lobby are doing now is saying, well, we can't win it on the moral one. That doesn't work. We're going to chip away at the edges. We're going to bring in spurious issues of mental health, which the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has, as recently as last year, said there was no evidence to support that. They're bringing in this thing about reducing the limit, pictures of fetal parts, babies crying. It's all to try and chip away at an argument they know they've lost, because their reality is, who is going to say we're going to go back to a situation where we abortion is illegal and we don't have the safety valve in Ireland where women go to the UK? And imagine the scenario in Ireland if that actually happened. There would be revolt, and we would have, as Mary Harney herself has said back as late as a long time ago, 1992, she said that if Ireland was an island out in the middle of the Atlantic, we'd have legislated for abortion already. And she's quoted in the Irish Times as that. Now, she has admitted that if we didn't have the safety valve of the UK, we would have abortion in Ireland. It's not palatable, it's not pleasant, but it's a reality.
For generations, we didn't have legal abortion, and although it's true that sometimes there were illegal backstreet abortions, most people got alongside someone when they became pregnant and helped them through that difficult period and ensured the baby was born. All over Europe, we're seeing massive reductions in our population levels, we're failing to reproduce ourselves, and now we're destroying our unborn on an unparalleled scale. And now the British Parliament is seeking to impose the same legislation in Northern Ireland, despite the fact that all parties in the Assembly have opposed such an extension. Why is that? It's because perhaps in a place like Northern Ireland, people understand better than most that violent solutions are not the way to solve problems. My right to choose is the slogan that people like Mary constantly use. Me, my, I at the heart of the equation. Rights, not our responsibilities, not our duties, not our obligations to the powerless and the voiceless. And choice. Well, all choices carry consequences. And freedom for the pike is death for the minnow. And we have to decide on who stands side we stand. There's a great writer, G.K. Chesterton, who said that to admire mere choice is to refuse to choose.
David, what are you campaigning for actively in Britain? I mean, you believe that a human life must be respected from the moment of conception, but in practical terms, it's 24 weeks at the moment. What do you think you can achieve in your campaign?
Well, 20 years ago, I introduced a bill into the British Parliament to reduce the upper time limit, and that bill never lost a vote at any stage. 296 MPs voted for it, and that was a reduction to 18 weeks. And I know that attempts will be made in the current Human Fertilisation and Embryology Bill to reduce the upper time limit when disabled babies can be aborted and to reduce the time limit when, in other circumstances, babies are aborted, down to at least 20 and perhaps 18 weeks.
So you accept what Mary says, that it's a fact of life, it's part of the fabric of British life and indeed by extension of Irish life, that it's not going to go away, but you feel you can mitigate some of the worst excesses, is that
exactly
it?
I mean, just because you can't save 100 lives on a ship that is sinking, it doesn't stop you from saving the 10. You don't stand back and say, I can't save any. So incrementally, yes, I would challenge the law, but I would plead with people like Mary, good doctors, to challenge this culture of death, see the destructive effects this is having on both their patients, and to look for alternatives. And that is why I get involved in the hospice movement. It's why the Life Organisation has set up Life Houses to give women who feel they have no choice, many of them will be Irish women, who arrive in Britain and they come to a Life House instead of to the abortion clinic, and they go ahead and have their baby, and those babies are adopted. So there are alternatives, and we must promote those actively. But the current bill goes way beyond the abortion issue. I've been challenging many of its provisions during the debates in the House of Lords. One of them is to permit the creation of animal-human hybrid embryos. And, you know, the devaluation of life generally through the abortion legislation has paved the way for all these other things. We permit the cloning of human embryos. 2.2 million human embryos destroyed or experimented on. This same legislation also removes from the legislation the need for a father, and people will be able to tamper with birth certificates to put somebody else's name on the birth certificate. Where are we going to with all of this?
By the way, do you favour the existence and the use of the morning after pill?
The morning after something is a bit like saying, do I favour experiments on the unborn for 14 days? 14 days after something. Life begins at conception, and we should always err on the side of caution. So I think our choices are made earlier than that. Our choices are made when we have sexual relations. Our choices are made if we decide not to be faithful inside our marriages. Our choices are made. And when a baby is conceived, a new person enters the equation. It's because I care passionately about human rights. That's why I come to this issue, not out of some false sense of morality. It's because
Mary,
I believe in human
question,
rights, and the right to life is paramount. That's what the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights said.
Mary, that question of the morning after pill?
It seems extraordinary to me that David Alton is suggesting that we should not have access to emergency contraception in the form of what's known as the morning after pill, because he suggests that life begins at conception before implantation. I mean, this is returning to the Dark Ages, and I think it's an example of...
When do you think life begins then, Mary?
Life begins when the baby is born, in terms of a real sense of a sentient human being that has rights and that...
Could that baby survive once it's born if you or I didn't care for it, if a paediatrician wasn't present, if a midwife wasn't there?
But it has rights that are recognised by society when it's born.
And the day before it's born, it has no rights.
So are you suggesting that the rights of a woman, the rights of a newborn baby, are the same as an embryo before it's actually implanted?
I think all of us are unique. I think we're all made in the image of God and therefore precious in His eyes.
Can I ask you, Mary, it's a kind of a global question. It might sound a bit facile, but I don't mean it in that way. And what David was talking about is a huge demand for childless couples, both in Britain and in Ireland, for children. And we are going to all sorts of high-tech lengths in fertility clinics and so on to facilitate that demand. And it's not an easy process for women, the administration of these procedures. And in fact, it can fracture partnerships and families. It's so difficult. And yet you have all these children who are being aborted. And if you were an economist, you'd say, look, here we have a supply, a potential supply. Here we have a demand. Is there not some way that we can allow the supply to meet the demand?
Yes, and it seems a simple solution. Unfortunately, you'd need the consent of the 6,000 Irish women who travel every year to participate in that. And if it happened to your family member or my family member, would you be the person who encourages them to do that? Because it would be their choice. I don't see women making that choice, and the reality is they're not.
No, but is there ways in which that choice might be encouraged?
I'm sure there are, but I don't think anybody would be in a rush to take it up. Because, I mean, the issue of adoption does exist, but women are actively choosing not to pursue that option now, because that's really the equivalent. The women are entitled to make their own individual choice to determine their own fertility, and this is the choice they're making. And they will continue to make it, and potentially in increasing numbers, as women choose to delay fertility in their 20s, later into their 30s, with potential repercussions in terms of lower fertility, but that's the choice women are making. And we will see a potentially rising abortion rate because of that, irrespective of good contraception and irrespective of the difficulties infertile couples have on the other side of the equation.
Final words from you, David.
I don't think we're looking at this in the right way. I think we should be upholding life from the womb to the tomb. And we should be getting alongside people when they find themselves in a crisis situation and providing them with alternatives. And simply offering them the quick fix of an abortion, it doesn't solve the problem. All it does is create great pain. Often it leads to those women becoming separated from their partners or their husbands. It leads to a lot of post-abortion trauma. It can lead to physical sequelae. And it leads to the death of their unborn child. So this isn't a solution that any self-respecting doctor should be advocating.
We're going to leave it there. We've ventilated the arguments. Thank you very much to you both, Lord David Alton, joining us from our Galway studio, and Dr. Mary Favier from Doctors for Choice.